It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, the Trump administration plans to rescind the Clean Power Plan. We'll discuss what that means for coal-fired power plants, for coal, and for other energy providers in Pennsylvania. Plus, a mistrial in the federal civil case against a police officer charged in connection with the shooting of a young Pittsburgh area man. Will this hurt efforts to improve police-community relations? But first, more and more candidates want a shot at Pennsylvania's 18th congressional seat that'll be vacated late next week by Republican Tim Murphy. Some of the names are familiar, some not so familiar. We're going to talk about the 18th's upcoming special election and what chances Democrats have to recapture the seat with two local politics reporters, Chris Potter with the Post-Gazette and Wes Van Teicher from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Gentlemen, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, Kevin.
You're invited to join the discussion. Please tweet your questions or comments. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right. October 4th, Tim Murphy announces he will not seek a ninth two-year term. That came after the Post-Gazette reported that Murphy, a member of the House Pro-Life Caucus, allegedly asked a woman with whom he was having an affair to get an abortion during a pregnancy scare. The next day, House Speaker Paul Ryan announced that Murphy would resign October 21st, 14 months before his current term ends. Here's Ryan's statement, or at least part of it. Quote, "It was Dr. Murphy's decision to move on to the next chapter of his life, and I support it," end quote. Of course, Paul Ryan called him Dr. Murphy because Murphy is a psychologist by training. So, gentlemen, the fact that the House Speaker made the announcement seems like he and others might not want that controversy to linger for 14 months. Chris?
Yeah, there's pretty strong indication that although the choice, of course, was Congressman Murphy's, he had a little help. I mean, there was reporting both in our publication and in a Politico, the National Political Journal, that there was a lot of concern. Not even so much about the extramarital affair, but about how Congressman Murphy's staff had been treated. There was some pretty striking allegations that folks were just being treated badly. And there was concern within House Republican leadership in particular that there might be some sort of ethics investigation and this thing would kind of linger on. And so that had a big part to do with accelerating his departure.
Certainly. And of course, we can't forget the hypocrisy involved in this of being so strongly pro-life, long voting record of being pro-life, and at the same time asking for an abortion.
So before we get to the special election to decide who will serve out the remaining months of Murphy's current term, so how likely was it that Murphy was going to face a challenger in the upcoming primary from his own party? Do we have any sense?
I had no sense whatsoever that there was any movement afoot to replace him. I think the only time that Congressman Murphy really has faced a serious challenge in Congress, in my memory, actually did come from his own party. Evan Feinberg, several years ago, sort of ran a Tea Party opposition to Mr. Murphy when that movement was sort of at its high watermark. But this district was raided by, you know, sort of the people who raid congressional districts, solid Republican, safe Republican. He had name recognition. He had all the stuff you need. And, I mean, part of what makes this such a stunning fall for him was he was kind of at the height of his powers. The very day our story came out, sort of talking about these texts between he and the woman he was having an affair with, that very morning, Speaker Ryan lauded his mental health bill as landmark legislation. This was a bill he had passed. He has been a practicing psychologist for many years, and this mental health bill kind of reform was widely lauded as being sort of capstone legislation for him. So he seemed to be in very good shape up until this summer when we began reporting, especially Paula Reed Ward, our courts reporter, began reporting on some of what was going on here.
Wes, had you heard any rumblings that he might face an inside party challenger in the primary?
Certainly not from his own party. I mean, in the last election, he didn't even have any challengers in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Last couple. And yes, it is very deeply Republican. It seems to be getting more so. So it came as quite a surprise for everyone.
So a few Democrats have already stated their intention. They actually stated it prior to Mr. Murphy's decision to not run for reelection and then resign his seat, including Mike Crossey, retired teacher, former Allegheny County Councilman, head of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, Pam Iovino, former Veterans Administration official, and Bob Solomon, an emergency physician. Then just yesterday, I believe it was, Westmoreland County Commissioner Gina Cirilli.
Yes.
So I get the only elected official there is Commissioner Cirilli. Are we hearing any more names that might be bandied? Because they're not really well-known
right.
names, per se.
Right. So the other and part of the dynamic here was up until this news happened, the three candidates you mentioned first there were basically planning to run against Tim Murphy as an incumbent in the office or whatever.
Right.
There just wasn't, you know, there's been a lot of talk after the 2016 election among Democrats. We're going to fight every race, 67 county strategy, 50 state strategy or whatever. But it hasn't necessarily produced a ton of candidates. What you've seen is these kind of more grassroots kind of efforts. So these are not big names that people are familiar with. But to answer your question, yeah, there's at least one more name that seems very likely to add, Connor Lamb, who is has been an assistant U.S. attorney here in the Pittsburgh office.
Related to the controller?
The nephew of the city controller, exactly. So he's expected to announce pretty much any day now. There may be another entry in there, Matt Smith, the former state senator who represents the 37th, who represented the 37th district in the South Hills, is also said to be weighing a run right now. And I would expect to hear something from him in the next few days, one way or the other, sometime next week.
Of course, you mentioned Matt Smith, former state senator, also I believe he's president of the Pittsburgh Chamber of Commerce.
That's
okay.
Right.
So are you anticipating any more bigger name Democrats, West, to enter this race? Any sense that you're hearing beyond those names that Chris mentioned?
I've not heard anything more, no. I do think it is important to note that several of these candidates were planning to run before this scandal with Murphy. They thought they had a chance out there. This district technically has more registered Democrats than Republicans, even though—
You say technically. Why? Okay.
Well, it does have more
we're talking tens of thousands, the margin.
Yes, yes. Something like 55% Democrats, I believe. And that doesn't change the fact that they have voted heavily Republican in the last couple of presidential elections. Clinton only got 39% of the vote out there. Trump got about 58%. The two presidential elections before that had similar margins.
Yeah. Right.
And that's why these political reporting agencies rate it so heavily Republican. So we'll see what kind of grassroots campaign they can mount, how far that goes.
So Democrats, Chris, who don't vote Democratic down the line.
Yeah, that's right. And so, one of the arguments from one of the Democratic candidates, it'll be very interesting to see kind of how Democrats sort of figure this out, because this will be a special election. And what that means is there's not a primary here. The candidate, the nominee for each party will basically be chosen by the committee people within that district. These are kind of the foot soldiers of the party here. So it'll really come down to sort of Democrats sort of deciding for themselves, you know, what kind of Democrat do we want to have here? You've got on the one hand, Gina Cirilli, who you mentioned a few minutes ago, Westmoreland County Commissioner, identified herself to me yesterday as being pro-life, pro-sportsman, which I think is a nice way of saying pro-gun, and pro-union. So you've got that kind of Democrat on the one hand. And then I think what you've got is some of the Democrats who hail from Allegheny County, who skew a little more liberal, especially on social issues than that. So and part of what makes 18 a tough district for Democrats, I think, is precisely that you've got the kind of South Hills of Allegheny County, but you've also got these sort of more rural and more kind of conservative areas. And I think the difference between an Allegheny County and a Westmoreland County is harder to negotiate for Democrats than it is for Republicans. And I think that's one of the dynamics that you'll be watching ahead in the months ahead.
Yeah. Wes, Chris mentioned that, of course, the nominees for this special election will be chosen by the committee people of the parties. How different do we think that the committee people are from these different counties? Because we're talking about parts of four counties, I believe, Washington, Westmoreland, Allegheny, and Greene. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, they all have a good number of Republican voters in them, along with the Democrats. It's kind of a different process for each of the two parties. The state law lets them allow by party rules how they select their nominees for the Democrats. They get all the members of these committees, something like 260 people or so, together and each one votes on their favorite candidate. The Republicans is a little bit different. There are state rules based on how many people live in different areas, and kind of the party chair has a little bit more power in terms of selecting a few people that will get together and make a decision on their own. So that definitely changes the dynamic of how the preferred candidate emerges here.
And one of the factors to consider there as well is that the sort of geographical distribution here. If you look at the Democratic side, and my guess is Ms. Cirilli is probably counting on this, you've got several folks from Allegheny County, and she's out there on her own from Westmoreland at this point. So, you know, you maybe split that vote. And I know that's on the Republican side, you've got Guy Reschenthaler, state senator from the South Hills of Pittsburgh. You've got Rick Saccone, state representative from Elizabeth, both Allegheny County. And then you have Kim Ward, state senator from Westmoreland. So again, you kind of got two women from Westmoreland County here who may benefit just a little bit from the fact that there's sort of a multi-candidate field from Allegheny County. And those are the two kind of big counties. And then so you get into like, where's Washington County fall into all of this? A lot of votes down there for, you know, for both parties. That may sort of be the swing county. Now, Green is a much smaller area, but it'll be interesting to see kind of who is best equipped to kind of pitch themselves to those Washington County folks.
And the fourth Republican that is declared is George Karpak, as sort of pro-farmer, and he describes himself as a family man from Castle Shannon. I want to talk a little bit about the district. You gentlemen have addressed it. I want to go a little deeper into this district. You talked about the voter registration edge for the Democrats. This 18th, now this has, of course, been redrawn every 10 years after a census, but it's gone Republican for 8 straight elections, but it's had a mix of Democrats and Republicans holding that seat over the last 35 years. I mean, we can go back to John Hines, to Doug Walgren, to Rick Santorum, and now we are really going at the spectrum there, the political spectrum, to Mike Doyle, who, and of course, Mike Doyle was then redistricted into the 14th district in 2002, to eventually the current seat holder, Tim Murphy. So does that give hope to the Democrats or not in trying to regain this seat? I mean, because there have been Democrats, but the lines have been drawn every 10 years. So the Democrats have hope?
I mean, I'd say they had more hope than they did a couple months ago, right, because of the turmoil here. But, I mean, this is a tough district, and it's not just a matter of party registration. It's culturally. I mean, if you look at Tim Murphy, he's sort of a singular guy. On the one hand, he was conservative on issues of life, and that's kind of what got him into trouble here recently. He was also pro-labor in some ways. He did take kind of union-friendly votes at various points in his career and was a sort of a strong critic of trade regimes that allowed for steel dumping. That, too, appealed to his district. He was also, as we said, a medical professional. So in a weird sort of way, he kind of had cobbled together a political identity that appealed to this sort of scattershot, this sort of social scattershot nature of this district. You have your prosperous suburbs like Mount Lebanon, like Upper St. Clair, like Peters. You had your more rural areas in the district, and then you had your kind of working class sort of industrial or post-industrial communities, and it's tough to bridge all of those different communities.
It is. I mean, it is. There are some things that are not that different about this district. The whole thing is like 95% white.
Yeah.
It's, I think, the second whitest district in the state. It's decently educated. Like 37% of the people living in there have a bachelor's degree, and pretty like. People are okay out there in terms of like economically. Yeah.
Median income, I think the household median income is around 55,000 or so.
Yeah.
So it's the voters are doing pretty well economically.
And one thing that Democrats say gives them hope is kind of trying to see how much this is might be a referendum on either Tim Murphy himself or on President Trump. As we said earlier, the district did vote heavily Trump. And approval ratings for Trump across the country are somewhat low. I think they're usually hovering around 35% these days. But people in these counties say that he's still very well supported. I was just talking with Michael Corns, the head of the Republican committee in Westmoreland County. He says that they still are very much in favor of Trump. And if anything, they just want to support him in terms of getting Congress more behind him. But Democrats say this people are not satisfied with Trump. They're going to get out and vote. They're going to vote Democratic. People who haven't voted will vote Democratic, et cetera.
Yeah.
That'll be interesting because one of the candidates specifically, Republican candidates, specifically mentioned, I want to go and help President Trump drain the swamp. And it'll be interesting, whoever it happens to be, whether how closely they'll align themselves with the president.
Right. And Wes put his finger, I think, on the big hope for Democrats in this special election and into the judicial races coming up next month as well, just the regular election that we're having statewide, is this feeling that it has been a difficult environment for Republicans in special elections. Probably the best example is the Georgia 6th district to replace Tom Price down there. And a Democrat who actually did not even live within the district came fairly close, a lot closer than people would have thought, in a solid red district. The downside of that, of course, is that Democrats on a couple of these races have come close but not won it. So what you've seen is a couple of these, I mentioned them before, kind of the University of Virginia Center of Politics, move this district from a kind of safe Republican to, you know, leans Republican. So there's been, because of that factor, a Cook Political Report did something similar this morning. So there has been this sense that these special elections, because of the national political environment, you know, the Democrats might have an advantage that they might not have had otherwise. But it's still the landscape is forbidding. And the best tell of that is when you look at how Democrats and Republicans responded to this news. The Republicans came out, the National Republican Campaign Committee, which tries to get Republicans elected to the House, said, we're going to hold this district. We're going to hold this district. The Democratic side said, you know, we're going to watch this district. And I mean, that's what the Democrats were telling me 6 months ago. So in a way, you know, there's, you know, I think there's a bit of tamping down of expectations in some circles.
All right. We have just 2 minutes left. I'm going to get to this. Now, it's up to the governor to set the special election date. I mean, chances are he's going to put it in with the primary. Chances?
I think that's
right. And because part of it is the cost of running a separate election. So there could be a bit of a hiccup here for voters if the special election is held the same day as the primary election. Party committees, of course, will choose their nominee they want to appear on the special election ballot. But many of these contenders, Republican, Democrat, will seek the standard nomination as well for the primary. So voters could see one name at the top of the special election and the same name plus lots of other candidates listed for the full term primary. How confusing can this be, and how much of an opportunity is it if the special election is listed above and so that person's name gets listed basically twice? Start with you, Wes. We have just 2 minutes left.
Yeah, I mean, that is very confusing. It's hard to say what impact that could have. You do have some split ticket voters, and so I don't know if that would cause someone to go one way on this top of the ballot item and then switch further down, affecting state races. It's certainly confusing.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, I think that'll be good. And the split ticket thing is an interesting thing. You could very easily see a certain kind of Democrat voting for Gina Cirilli in the primary if she decides to do that, and who even knows how that's going to play out, but then voting for a Republican in the actual special election itself. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that party leaders have to sort of sweat out and figure, and it's like trying to play 11th dimensional chess for them and for the voters as well.
All right, 15 seconds for each of you. What are you two going to be keeping an eye on as this moves forward, Wes?
I'm going to be keeping an eye on I'd like to get out there and talk to people. I don't know what these people are really saying personally, and I want to get a better sense of healthcare, how much that weighs on what they're doing, and how big of an impact jobs in the economy are there for these people.
Chris?
I mean, the field is still unsettled yet, so I'll be interested in that. And I'll also be interested, too, to see to what extent Democrats are willing to sort of invest resources in this race, because this is the kind of race that if you want to recapture the House, it would really be great for Democrats to pick up.
Wes Van Tyscher is a reporter covering politics for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, and Chris Potter covers politics for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Gentlemen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
If the Trump administration eliminates the Clean Power Plan, will that help the coal industry and hurt renewables in Pennsylvania? That's next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The Pittsburgh Penguins visited the White House with the Stanley Cup on Tuesday. President Donald Trump called the team, quote, incredible patriots. Head coach Mike Sullivan said the visit was not a platform for the team to take a stance. And computer scientists are using artificial intelligence to create more accurate flu forecasts. The forecast can help predict when the flu will take off and when it will peak. Find more top news at WESA.FM.
It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Trump administration announced this week it is proposing to revoke the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, but with no plans to replace it. Will this be a boost to the coal industry? How will it affect the overall economy and the environment? Let's address those questions and others with Laura Legere, reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette covering energy issues. Welcome, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And in studio with us is Reed Frazier, reporter with our content partner, the Allegheny Front. Welcome back to the show, Reed.
Hey, Kevin.
In signing this proposal to revoke the Clean Power Plan, EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt indicated that the Obama-era rule exceeded federal law by setting emission standards that power plants could not reasonably meet. So let's start off with, what were the key requirements of the Clean Power Plan? Let's start with you, Laura.
Well, the proposal was to cut carbon emissions from the power sector, so generally power plants, by 32% nationwide by 2030. That's compared to 2005 levels. But it gave individual states individual goals and also wide latitude to design their own program for meeting their goals. The plan would have gone beyond what's called the fence line of the coal-fired power plant to consider the power sector as a whole. The idea being that although there are some things you can do to coal-fired power plants to cut down on carbon emissions, the standard things that you can do really wouldn't be enough to make a dramatic impact on cutting carbon. So the idea was to look at the power sector generally and try to cut it across the board. That meant things like adopting more renewable energy, cutting down on energy use, things that an individual power plant couldn't do simply by flipping a switch.
Reed, fence line, what's meant by that? And also, Laura mentioned 32% overall, and different states had different numbers. And what about Pennsylvania's requirements?
Yeah, so the thing that was different about the Clean Power Plan versus past Clean Air Act regulations is that typically the Clean Air Act, the EPA would go in and say, you know, for this power plant, you have to install XYZ, like the best equipment for to reduce sulfur dioxide or nitrogen oxides, common pollutants. With the Clean Power Plan, instead of regulating the sort of tailpipe at that power plant, they took the electrical industry as a whole and say, we're regulating this whole industry as one, basically one common tailpipe. And that was argued by attorneys general, including Scott Pruitt, the current EPA.
He was from Oklahoma, right?
He was from Oklahoma, and argued that that was illegal. That was an overreach, that the Clean Air Act doesn't authorize you to just take the whole sector, that it, instead you have to go factory by factory, tailpipe by tailpipe. You know, the problem with that is that there's really no, as Laura alluded to, there's really no easy way to cut carbon dioxide by as much as we really need to do something significant about climate change. Now, the state requirements for Pennsylvania were to cut carbon emissions by about a third from the power sector by 2030. And, you know, the analysis that came out of this proposal was that Pennsylvania was one of the a few states that would really have to do a lot more than it's already doing to meet its expectations.
Well, Laura, let me follow that up with you. In your reporting, you mentioned an analysis of compliance and what would be needed in terms of emissions reductions. You mentioned that it sort of depends on the cost of natural gas and renewables.
That's right. There was an analysis that the Rhodium Group put out on Monday. And what they showed was that some states and the country overall are on a pretty good trajectory to meet the goals that the EPA, the Obama EPA, had set out for the Clean Power Plan because of market forces. Basically, right now, natural gas is incredibly cheap. Wind and solar are inexpensive. The demand for electricity is fairly flat. So you have all of these market forces that are really cutting carbon emissions. But the question is going to be if those trends continue. And so the Rhodium Group looked and it said that if gas and renewables are expensive, if for some reason they become much more expensive than they look like they will be, then Pennsylvania would have to do a significant amount more than just glide along with market forces in order to meet its goals. But if gas and renewables stay cheap, it really wouldn't have had to do anything extra other than what the market is already doing, which is it's closing coal-fired power plants that just can't compete against those cheaper sources. Now, that Pennsylvania is an interesting state because its difference between expensive gas and cheap gas really makes a big difference in terms of how much it would have to do to comply. West Virginia, on the other hand, whether gas is expensive or cheap, would have had to do a lot to comply with the Clean Power Plan. It really couldn't just follow a business-as-usual strategy and hope to meet or come anywhere close to its goals.
In your reporting, you both spoke with former Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection Secretary John Quigley. Let's hear from him.
It will allow Pennsylvania to emit more CO2 and soot and other pollutants than it otherwise would have under the rule.
Reed, your thoughts, your comments, and then Laura.
So what he's talking about is just the idea that we're going to burn more coal in Pennsylvania because of this decision to pull back from the Clean Power Plant, and coal produces smog and soot, and those are, you know, they have known public health impacts.
Laura?
That's true. So one of the questions about what the Trump administration is doing, both sides have accused the other side of sort of fuzzy math in terms of calculating the benefits. And one of the things that the Obama EPA did was calculate human health benefits that would come from not the carbon reductions themselves, but these associated pollutants that Reed is talking about, the sort of conventional pollutants that contribute to lung disease and asthma and shorten people's lives. Those things would be a co-benefit of cutting carbon, but the two EPAs and the two administrations have very different perspectives on what the appropriate way of calculating those benefits would be.
EPA Administrator Pruitt said, quote, "The war on coal is over." So is this a reprieve for the coal industry? I mean, Pennsylvania is still, what, number four in production? Or is it just a stabilization or a slowing of the decline? Reed, then Laura.
Well, I mean, I think the problem for the coal industry is that, you know, regardless of what, Donald Trump or Scott Pruitt does with coal, you know, there's a realization among energy companies or utilities that sooner or later we're going to have some kind of carbon regulations. We're going to have either a carbon tax or a cap and trade. It may not happen in 4 years or 8 years. And, you know, utility companies need to plan decades in advance of how they're going to produce their electricity. And so no one is going to go out and build a, you know, possibly a billion-dollar coal-fired power plant, because in 8 years, we could have a different president, or 4 years, we could have just a different president, a different Congress. So that's really what's, I think, vexing the coal industry right now.
Laura?
Yeah, there's some interesting, Pennsylvania is an interesting case study right now in how quickly things can change. So nobody anticipated that natural gas would be quite so cheap for so long. Pennsylvania, because it's in the heart of the Marcellus and Utica shale development, is seeing just a tremendous amount of gas. And because of that, there's also a tremendous build-out in new natural gas-powered electricity plants. And actually, there are enough permits in the queue in under Pennsylvania's regulatory system for proposed natural gas-fired power plants that they have enough capacity to replace all of Pennsylvania's coal-fired power plants. That's not saying all of them will be built, but the market alone is proposing just a massive build-out of natural gas-fired power plants that are just cleaner in many ways than coal. Even if a coal-fired power plant can switch to run on natural gas, it's just not going to be as efficient as a new natural gas-fired power plant, and there's obviously an appetite to invest in building more of those.
The Trump administration removed references to many Obama-era initiatives from the EPA website very soon after taking office. The Trump EPA doesn't want to even mention climate change. In fact, the phrase climate change doesn't appear in the agency's draft four-year strategic plan that was released for public comment last week.
Yeah, I mean, this is administration-wide. This is not just the EPA. This is in every agency that touches on environmental issues. Donald Trump called climate change a hoax several times. Scott Pruitt, it says he is not sure about the science of climate change. So this is part of the source code for this administration, is that, you know, taking a contrarian view of climate change, that it's not happening. contrary to the vast majority of scientists who say it's happening, we're the cause of it, and the consequences are going to be large.
Laura, we've been talking impact on the coal industry, impact on the environment or potential impact. What about the impact on the economy as a whole?
Well, you know, one of the things that is that energy efficiency and renewable energy groups say is that their sector is the one that is the promising growth sector in energy right now. There's just been tremendous growth in things like people who install better insulation in homes and businesses, retrofitting heating and ventilation for industrial sites. There is just a lot of investment right now in cutting down on energy use. And there's a lot of jobs that's very work intensive. So some people have criticized the proposed repeal of the rule because the administration seems to be turning its back on a very promising growth sector.
Reed, Kevin Sunday of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry said the repeal would be a victory for consumers and businesses. The revocation, would it actually reduce energy bills, referring to victory for consumers?
You know, the coal industry says this, but I haven't seen any analysis that I, you know, feel like is an unbiased analysis that shows that it would. You know, the Clean Power Plan gave great, it was very flexible in terms of what different states could do. So if, I mean, in Pennsylvania, switching to more natural gas hasn't really hurt electric bills. It has also lowered the carbon emissions from the power sector. Renewables have become a lot cheaper, in some cases competitive, cost competitive with regular fossil fuels.
Final question to both of you. Is there any indication that the EPA will actually design a replacement rule, and what might that look like? We'll start with you, Laura.
They have to design a replacement rule. That's because there was a Supreme Court case, I believe in 2007, Massachusetts versus EPA, where the Supreme Court said that carbon dioxide is a pollutant, and under the Clean Air Act, I believe, something is considered to be an air pollutant, you have to take steps to reduce it and regulate it. So the EPA designed what's called an endangerment finding that declares that carbon dioxide is legally a pollutant. So unless Scott Pruitt decides to rescind the endangerment finding, he's getting some pressure to do that, but there's doubt that he will. The EPA has to come up with some kind of plan for regulating carbon emissions from the power sector. You know, the question, though, is how effective will that be in terms of making any substantial change in carbon emissions if all you're asking coal plants to do is make, you know, what are fairly modest emissions that are possible without some kind of massive investment in carbon capture technology.
You know, carbon capture is the technology where you suck CO2 out of the flue gas of a coal-fired power plant and bury it or in some other way prevent it from getting into the atmosphere. So that's too expensive for them to do a regulation conventionally. Scott Pruitt has been on the side where that says that you can't just shut down coal-fired power plants because they release too much CO2. So what they're likely going to do is tell coal-fired power plants that they have to increase their efficiency, but that's not going to get close to what the Clean Power Plan would have done in terms of reducing CO2 from the power sector.
Reed Frazier is a reporter with our content partner, the Allegheny Front. Laura Legere is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette covering energy issues. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Coming up, the impact on police-community relations of the mistrial in the Leon Ford case. That's when the confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, the Pittsburgh Pirates win their third World Series thanks to a Game 7 walk-off home run by second baseman Bill Mazeroski. The 1960 bottom of the ninth home run is still the only time in baseball history that such a play has won the World Series. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 13th, 2017.
It It's the Confluence where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Several days of deliberations resulted in mixed results in Leon Ford's civil case in federal court against two Pittsburgh police officers. The jury was deadlocked on whether Officer David Derbisch used excessive force against Leon Ford during a traffic stop in November of 2012. Ford was shot and is paralyzed. Some activists have said that this mixed verdict will be painful for the community. We're going to discuss this with David Harris. He's a University of Pittsburgh law professor and host of WESA's very popular podcast, Criminal Injustice. Welcome back, David. Good to have you here.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
Also in studio is WESA reporter Anlie Herring, who covers law and government. Welcome, Anlie.
Thank you.
As always, we encourage your comments and questions. Please tweet them. Use the hashtag WESAConfluence. So a bit of background. This happened during a traffic stop 5 years ago. Police were looking for a Lamont Ford. So a mistaken identity case to start off with.
Yes. The car was stopped. Leon Ford was driving. It was his car. He had all of the correct identification, a license, a registration, proof of insurance, all in his name. It all checked out. But the police officers on the scene seemed to think that he was actually a different person with the last name Ford. And they persisted in trying to figure that out, despite the fact that everything checked out at the scene. That was at the root of what happened here.
And Anlie, is that what came up during the course of this case?
Yeah, and at that point, there were only two officers on the scene, Andrew Miller and Michael Costco. And given the confusion over Ford's identity, they called a third officer, David Derbisch, to the scene, who had some familiarity with the gang member that they thought Leon Ford may have been. That gang member, Lamont Ford, had an active warrant, so he was wanted. So Derbisch arrived to the scene, and after that, he claims that he saw a bulge in Leon Ford's sweatpants that caused concern. He thought it might be a weapon. They asked Ford to exit the vehicle. Ford didn't want to. His lawyer, during the trial and during Ford's testimony, Ford said he was scared. So he resisted, and the officers tried to pull him out of the car. Eventually, Derbisch jumped into the car, and the car started to move, and Derbisch shot him 5 times.
And that gets to the car movement. That gets to sort of the defense of Officer Derbisch. Self-defense, the car's moving, so I shot him. Is that the essence of it?
Well, it's close. The idea is they're trying to get him out of the car. The car starts moving. Mr. Ford claimed during the trial he didn't know how or why the car was moving. He didn't do that deliberately. Actually has no recollection of it. Officer Derbisch jumped in as the car started to roll. There were allegations that this violated departmental policy, that you're not supposed to do that. And then when he was in the moving car, Derbisch shot Mr. Ford 5 times. Mr. Ford had no weapon, in fact.
Force, David, according to the law, force is allowed if police are in fear of their lives?
That's a decent brief. That's pretty broad, but police have the privilege to use force in carrying out their lawful duties. What they don't have the privilege to do is to use excessive force. So that's effectively what the claim was here in this civil case that Mr. Ford brought. It's important to remember, I've heard the term guilty and not guilty thrown around a lot. That's not really accurate. This is a civil case in which damages were at stake, and the jury was still not able to come to a conclusion as to the actions of Officer Derbisch. The jury was split.
Yeah, and it's really critical to realize that it is department policy not to shoot into a moving vehicle. One day, whenever I was at the trial, an expert testified that in addition to that, if an officer suspects that someone has a weapon, rather than engage that person, it would be better to take cover. And this expert was saying there are points around a vehicle where you're not in the suspect's sight line. So that was another option that the officers had. But with the vehicle's movement in that one short period of time, it's really going to be hard for Ford to to argue that that wasn't a factor in the reasonableness.
Leon Ford's attorney, Fred Rabner, he told you on Lee after the verdict came in that his client wasn't surprised and that Rabner said that he felt the deck was stacked against Leon Ford.
This is a swing and miss by this jury. I think it's an opportunity lost by this jury. I think it's a microcosm of the problem in our country that a jury would hear that overwhelming avalanche of evidence against the officer's behavior and still come out deadlocked.
Yeah, it's really important to recognize, as many do, that the context of this case is much broader than Pittsburgh. It's a national conversation regarding police use of force against predominantly Black individuals. And that is the backdrop for this case. And in a lot of these cases, officers are absolved and don't face legal consequences. So the community really has had a lot invested in the outcome of this case. So it's continued uncertainty and a lot of emotion for a lot of people.
David, Unley used the term broader. Are there broader implications to this case?
Oh, I think so. You know, David Kennedy of John Jay College and the National Network for Safe Communities, he was on my podcast not too long ago. And one of the things he said is that when you have an incident like this, the majority community says that was a terrible thing, or might say the officer did a terrible thing, or that was a bad officer. The Black community, African American community, says this is history. This is what we have always experienced, and any case like this will be seen differently in just that way. We have to put this case into this more recent set of conversations in the country. And that's why the expectations may have been different here, that this one might come out differently because of the actions of the officer leaping into the car and the very significant injury to Mr. Ford. It's important to remember, though, that the law really hasn't changed. The law remains the same, and the law makes these cases very, very tough for a plaintiff like Mr. Ford to win. The jury also comes in with a presumption that the police have basically done the right thing and that they're the good guys, and that those are very hard things to work against if you're Mr. Ford or his attorneys.
And David Kennedy, the gentleman that you mentioned from John Jay College, he's worked in Pittsburgh
and
several other cities,
yes,
trying to help officers deal with their unconscious bias.
Well, he's worked a lot on stemming violence and homicide, and he has done that here in Pittsburgh. He is his organization is back doing some of that now. He's been very successful in many places. And one of the things he says consistently is you can have all kinds of police reform work, but if you don't deal with the relationship between police and African-American communities that has accumulated over so many years, you will not get true reform work done. And my fear with this case, putting aside the law and the technicalities of the outcome, is that it really may have set back any effort to promote and create better relations, because African-Americans will look at this and say, here's another example of how we can't or won't get justice, just like the Jordan Miles verdict, just like so many others.
Well, you mentioned that, and let's take a look at some of the cases and their implications. On Lee mentioned the community had a vested interest, and I think it goes back historically why they've had a vested interest in this particular case, because there have been several cases of allegations of excessive use of force by police officers, both in county court, federal court, without convictions. For instance, January 2010, three plainclothes officers stop 18-year-old Jordan Miles, a high school senior at the time. He says they beat him. They claim he fell on some rocks. No criminal conviction for the officers. But then a jury in the civil suit found that they did use excessive force. 22 years ago this week, you mentioned Johnny Gamage. It was 22 years ago this week. He was stopped for, he's a Black motorist, cousin of a Pittsburgh Steeler at the time, Ray Seals, for driving erratically. Three officers were charged in his asphyxiation death, basically pinned him to the ground. Mm-hmm. It was such force that his lungs couldn't accept air, and he died from that. One officer was acquitted in a separate trial, two mistrials for the other two. So, David, these situations are not unique to Pittsburgh, though.
No, they're not. And, you know, if you think of Johnny Gamage, I mean, that's almost exactly the way that Eric Garner died in New York not long ago. The thing to remember here, and it's worth saying that the police officers involved in Johnny Gamage's death were not Pittsburgh police officers, though everybody thinks of it as a Pittsburgh case.
Yeah, they were suburban. He wound up stopping just inside the city
border. That's right. That's right. What people have to remember is that a significant portion of our Pittsburgh community looks at this as a continuing problem, not as one bad incident, as a history. And it seems to many folks as if whatever happens to an individual at the hands of police, justice is very, very hard to find. And that can put us on separate pages when we should all, hopefully, we want to all create good communities with strong public safety. But it's very difficult to do if you think that ultimately you don't have that kind of access to justice and things won't change.
Unley, when you were talking to community members and trying to sense their reaction to this particular case, David just mentioned sort of a historical line. Is there also sort of a national geographic line that's just sort of, so St. Louis, Ferguson, New York, Pittsburgh, that they see a commonality there?
I do think people do see a pattern here, and it does extend beyond Pittsburgh. One thing that really stands out about this case that has been mentioned in commentary and in my conversations with people is that Leon Ford is still alive to tell his version of the story and to take these officers to court. So that really is something noteworthy that people nationally have really pointed out. So it'll be interesting to see how that affects the case this next time around.
It's not a substitute for justice. That's it. It's not a substitute for justice within the criminal justice system. But are the chances for any satisfaction for a victim more likely to come in a civil damages trial, David?
Well, you prefaced it exactly the right way, Kevin, because if you talk to people, they don't consider even a civil victory, a civil court victory, to be real justice. They want to see victory or justice coming from a criminal charge or conviction. And we know how difficult that has been, not just in Pittsburgh, but in so many other places. Think of the Freddie Gray case in which all those officers, six officers, were charged. There wasn't a single conviction, and eventually all the cases were dropped. Most community members will tell you that a civil verdict, even a positive one, would be very cold comfort. It's worth remembering that in Jordan Miles' case, there was another split verdict. He did get some damages eventually, and even that has left a bad taste in the mouth of pretty much everyone who was involved in it.
All right. We have just about a minute left. There's the very occasional outlier to this. In 1995, Officer John Charmo fatally shot Jerry Jackson inside the Armstrong tunnels after a police chase. 6 years later, he pled guilty to involuntary manslaughter. But that is the exception to such cases. So in our remaining minute or so, I want to ask you, what do you feel are the implications of this? And in the Leon Ford case, and moving forward, there's going to be another trial, at least scheduled, or are we hearing talk of settlements? We'll start with you, Unley.
I mean, what fascinates me about this case is that the jury did deadlock on the charge against Officer Derbysh, which is a break from the pattern where we see this very favorable view toward law enforcement. So that could bode well for Leon Ford. It's hard to say.
Okay. About 30 seconds or so, David.
Kevin, I think that what strikes me is that this case falls into line with so many other disappointments that the African-American community has had over time in these situations. And without some kind of great change, we shouldn't expect to see things get different. I hope going forward that people will realize that when you have everything in order, it's your car, and you end up shot and paralyzed, there is just something wrong with that.
David Harris is a University of Pittsburgh professor of law. He's the host of WESA podcast Criminal Injustice. Onley Herring is WESA's reporter covering law and government. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank
Pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for The Confluence is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence, Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.